Today at Reader's Corner, Martin J. Blaser, author of Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues.
In addition to the harmful bacteria, there are many, many bacteria in the world that are either neutral or actually beneficial to us. National data suggest that the average child in the United States gets about 3 courses of antibiotics in the first 2 years of life, and by the time they're 20, they get about 17 courses. So that's a lot of antibiotic use. The good bacteria have an important role because they help fight the bad bacteria. They help protect us. So my concern is we think we're improving health, but in fact, we might be worsening health.
I'm Bob Kustra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Antibiotics are wonder drugs that can thwart disease and save lives, but they also have the potential to trigger new health problems when used indiscriminately, according to today's guest, medical doctor and microbiologist Martin J. Blaser. In his book, Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues, Dr. Blaser offers a cautionary look at these powerful drugs and some of their unintended consequences. The two-edged nature of antibiotics is tied to the way they work, he explains. Antibiotics don't just kill the bad bacteria that are making us sick. They also can destroy the good bacteria that help protect us from disease. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Dr. Blaser. He is the director of the Human Microbiome Program at New York University, the former chair of medicine at NYU's School of Medicine, and he also has served as president of the Infectious Diseases Society of America. Dr. Blaser joins us by phone for this interview. Martin J. Blaser, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Great to be back in Boise.
Great. Let's begin with this issue of your research. So many people I interview who have written books such as this are relying on second and third hand reports and the research that others have done. You've spent the bulk of your recent career, anyway, engaged in the very research that produces the outcome we find in this book.
Yeah, so I'm both a working doctor and a working scientist, and I spend most of my time doing medical research and reporting the findings of our research to scientists and doctors in conferences, reporting it through papers that we write. But as our work in this area has developed over the last few years, it became clear to me that I needed to begin to speak to the general public because the issues that we found are really, I believe, affecting everyone's health, and I'm concerned about the health of our children and our grandchildren to come. And it's not enough for me to be talking to scientists. People have to be concerned about their own health and also to lobby for the kinds of changes we're going to need to get on a better path.
Let's begin with the definitions. We all think we know what bacteria is, that is, those of us who are non-doctors. But on the other hand, the word microbe is not exactly a household word. So help us with just what the basis of your research is here.
Okay, well, let's start with bacteria. Bacteria are tiny little cells. They're little forms of life. In fact, most of the world was bacteria for the first 3 billion years of life on Earth. It was just bacteria. And even today, most forms of life on Earth are bacteria. Animals and plants, we came along much more recently. So bacteria are tiny little cells. They have the ability to multiply. And one bacteria today can become a million bacteria tomorrow and a billion bacteria by the next day. And, of course, that's how they were discovered, really, as causing disease, typhoid fever, cholera, tuberculosis. These are diseases caused by specific bacteria that are very harmful to us. But in addition to the harmful bacteria, there are many, many bacteria in the world that are either neutral or actually beneficial to us.
And where do the bacteria in our bodies come from essentially? I mean, I gather that they come from the mother at birth?
Well, this is a very important point. It's kind of the starting point of the journey. When we do a census of the human body, we find that most of the cells in the human body are bacterial. Maybe 70 to 90% of all the cells in your body are not Bob, they're bacteria. And what we know is that these bacteria are quite ancient. that you got a lot of them from your mother, and she got them from her mother, and so on and so forth. And when we study the evolution of the bacteria that are living in us and living in other animals, we see that it very much parallels the evolution of the animals. And this all suggests this idea of vertical transmission. When we're born, when we exit from the womb and pass through the birth canal, we're exposed to this world of bacteria, the whole world of bacteria. But our starting point are the bacteria that our mother gives us. And that's the way we mammals have been doing it for the last 100 million years. And as I go into the book, things are changing. But first, we can talk about the normal course of events.
So I assume that each person has a unique microbial signature?
We are both similar in many ways, and we are different. It's kind of, if you look at a person from afar, you can say they're a person that, in general, they have two arms and two legs. And as you get closer and closer, you see that they're more and more different. And when you look at their fingerprint, you find that each one is unique. And it's kind of like that if you begin to analyze the bacteria. If you look at a very high level, we're all similar. And when you look at a very fine level, we're all different.
So research studies seem to show that parts of this microbiome, the bacteria, are disappearing, generally speaking. What's causing this bacteria to disappear?
Let me take it back a step, and that is that when we think about us and all the bacteria living in us, we think of ourselves as an ecosystem, similar to a forest or a prairie or a marsh or an ocean. And there are certain kind of rules of ecology. And one of them is the general observation that in healthy ecosystems, there's a lot of diversity, that there are a lot of different forms of life present. And as ecosystems get sick, diversity drops. Certain organisms become dominant, and all the other ones kind of drop out or are very much diminished. And so we're interested in what's the biodiversity of us humans. And there have been studies done in the last few years that have compared people in the United States who've had all the fruits of development, of many different kinds of development over a century and more, to people in Africa and in Latin America. And what we find, surprisingly, or maybe not so, is that their diversity is much greater than ours. And in studies published a few years ago, it suggested that we in the U.S. had lost 15 to 25% of our diversity. More recent work that's actually going to come out in a few weeks, I'm a co-author on a big paper, suggests that we may have lost as much as 35 or 40% of our diversity over this last century.
So how did we lose that diversity?
Well, one of the aspects is certainly antibiotics. Another one has to do with clean water, which, of course, is a great thing. But it has the unexpected effects that we're not ingesting each other's bacteria quite as much. And we have all kinds of additives in our food that suppress bacteria. We're washing all the time with antibacterial substances. It's not hard to see how we may have lost diversity. And of course, in the U.S. today, a third of the babies are born by cesarean section, which means that they're missing that first passage out through the mom's birth canal. So I think it's all cumulative, and it's possibly has been cumulative across generations. But there's more and more evidence that we have lost diversity. And as a human ecologist, I'm concerned about that because of what we know about other ecological systems.
Today we're talking about the book Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. Our guest is its author, Martin J. Blaser. Could you back up just a bit? I was fascinated in your book about your description of the cesarean section and the way that affects or minimizes the bacteria that passes down to the child. Could you describe that for us?
Sure, sure. So remember, we humans are mammals, and mammals give birth to live babies, and the babies are born in a sterile or almost sterile womb, and then their birth consists of passing through a birth canal. And when they pass through the birth canal, in the case of humans, their mom's vagina, they are covered with the mom's bacteria, and they swallow the mom's bacteria. That's their introduction to life. And that, of course, is what mammals have been doing ever since mammals have been on the planet, which is at least 100 million years. But when babies are born by C-section, they miss that first journey. They're going right out through the skin, and they're missing those organisms. And there has been work that's been ongoing. Actually, my wife, Maria Gloria Dominguez Bello, has been studying this for a number of years, that shows that the babies born by C-section, microbiologically, early in their life, are different than kids born the natural way.
And there's no way to make up for that?
Well, she's actually doing studies to see if she can make up for that, and that's still an open question. Now, one of the points that immediately emerges is, who cares? Does it matter? Is there any consequence? And I can tell you that there's a growing literature that children born by C-section have higher risk for certain diseases, like type 1 diabetes, or celiac disease, or obesity. There have been 4 studies published in the last 3 years showing that kids born by C-section had a 10 to 30 or 40% higher risk of developing markers of obesity later in childhood compared to kids born naturally when you control for all other known factors.
Well, whether it's the C-section or whether it's the overuse of antibiotics, you refer to the modern plagues of today, and you made reference to that when you compared the United States to Africa. Just what are some of these modern plagues that we can attribute to this loss of diversity when it comes to bacteria?
Well, as a medical doctor and, you know, as a parent and as a person in the United States, it's clear that we're in the middle of an epidemic of obesity, where the rates of obesity have risen markedly in the last few decades. At the same time, we're in the middle of an epidemic of asthma and juvenile diabetes and food allergies and peanut allergies and celiac disease, inflammatory bowel disease, even autism. There have been about 10 diseases, more or less, that have risen quite dramatically in recent decades. Now, possibly, all 10 of them have different causes. Or another alternative is that there's something underlying all of them that is driving these diseases. And my hypothesis is that it's a change in our microbes, in our microbiome, those ancient organisms that we've had for millions of years, that the microbiome, which is so important early in life, is changing, and that's fueling all these different epidemics.
So what's going on in the life of a young child, a mother or father, who takes the child to the doctor with an ear infection or whatever else it is? In some ways, I've read, that's where the overuse of antibiotics starts.
Well, that's where it gets worse. It doesn't actually start there. It might start with the antibiotics that teenage girls are taking. And I single out girls because they're going to become the mothers. The tremendous antibiotic use in teenagers, for example, to treat acne for 6 or 12 months. There's some work suggesting that antibiotic use in the year before pregnancy increases risk of allergies in kids. Antibiotic use during pregnancy, right now the estimate is somewhere between 50 and 60% of pregnant women are receiving antibiotics during their pregnancy. I mentioned about C-section, which is changing the microbes. And national data suggests that the average child in the United States gets about three courses of antibiotics in the first 2 years of life. And by the time they're 10, they get about 10 courses. And by the time they're 20, they get about 17 courses. So that's a lot of antibiotic use. Now, some of it is just what you've mentioned, is ear infections. A young child is ill. The parent brings the child to the doctor. The doctor examines the child and sees that the child has an ear infection. And we know scientifically that about 80% of those ear infections are caused by viruses. Yet most of the time, the majority of the time, the child leaves the doctor's office with a prescription for antibiotics. Now, it turns out that antibiotics don't work against viruses. And for years, pediatrician associations, family medicine associations have been saying, cut down on antibiotic use for these kids. It's not needed. And one of the things that was driving their desire to cut it down was the fear about antibiotic resistance, which is growing. Every time we use antibiotics, we increase the likelihood of resistance in that person and in the community. But for a parent confronted by a screaming child and the doctor sympathetic to the parent and the child, they just think, well, that's kind of a remote fear, resistance. But now we're afraid that those early uses of antibiotics are increasing the child's risk of disease, of the fact that they may get obese or they may develop asthma. There are studies about this as well, epidemiologic studies showing kids who get early life antibiotics are more likely to have obesity, are more likely to develop asthma, more likely to develop inflammatory bowel disease. So that's a new dimension. That's something that's changed.
You touched on an issue that I was thinking of as you were explaining how this works, and that is that when you get into the doctor's office, it's not easy to just blame the doctor for the overuse or the prescription of the antibiotic, because the parent absolutely is clamoring for some relief. And a viral infection explanation is not probably going to be quite as effective. In fact, I was thinking, if you could get enough money to go on TV and replace some of these ridiculous pharmaceutical ads aimed at patients so they can beat up on their doctors about using these things, and have ads aimed at parents about the issue you're raising right now, I'll bet you could really cut down on the use of some of these antibiotics.
Well, that is why I wrote Missing Microbes.
Right,
and
right.
That's why I'm having the pleasure of talking to you to bring this message out to parents that what I'm hoping for a world is that a parent comes to the doctor with a child who's very ill and fussy. The doctor does an examination of the child. He says, I've done an examination of your child. The child isn't so sick. I don't think I need to give antibiotics. And the parent should feel relieved. The doctor has examined my child, that my child isn't so sick, and they're going to get better over time, which is mostly the case of what happens. There's a big gray area in medicine between the kids who must get antibiotics. They're really sick. They must get it. It would be a grave error not to give it to them. Fortunately, those kids are few in numbers. Then there's another end of the spectrum where the kids are just mildly ill. And then there's a big gray area in between. And doctors cut that gray area in different places. And family members, where they cut it, is affected by their level of anxiety as well. And what our work is showing, and the work of many other people as well, is that there's a cost to all that extra antibiotic. The dogma in the examining room was, this might not help your child, but it won't hurt. Well, there's more and more evidence that it will hurt, and that the hurt may be cumulative, that two courses of antibiotics are worse than one, and three courses are even worse. And remember, the average kid in the United States is getting 10 courses by the time they're 10.
So let's talk about Sweden for a minute. Why is it 40% less than Sweden? Who gets the credit for bringing that down so much in another country? Is it the doctor community? Is it?
I think it's the general culture of the country. In Europe, there are big differences between, let's say, Sweden and Italy. In Italy, antibiotic use is about three times as much as Sweden. In China, antibiotic use is much greater than it is in the United States. You don't even need a prescription to get an antibiotic. And what happens is when people don't feel well, they go and take an antibiotic, thinking it's going to make them feel better. And again, it's because antibiotics have been so miraculous, we've thought, well, I'm just going to take the antibiotic. It's going to cure me. But it only cures bacterial infections, and it's really only good for serious bacterial infections. The others are going to go away by themselves. So we have to rebalance this cost-benefit relationship. We're way over on the overuse side because we're not accounting for the cost. And the cost, I think, is going to be in these long-term chronic diseases. Asthma, peanut allergy, obesity.
You're listening to Martin J. Blaser. He's the author of Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. Now, you talk about broad-spectrum antibiotics in your book. Is that what we're talking about right now? And is there a way that doctors can prescribe antibiotics that aren't as broad-spectrum as the ones that you seem to be concerned about?
Well, I wonder if I can just back up for one moment, if I might, because there's something I forgot to mention before, which is very relevant and may be relevant to your audience in Idaho, and that is the discovery that antibiotics might affect development early in life was actually made about 70 years ago by farmers. Farmers found if they added low doses of antibiotics to the food or water of their livestock would get bigger faster. It's what's called growth promotion, and it works. The animals on the low-dose antibiotics gain weight more rapidly. They have increased feed efficiency. They can convert food calories into body mass more efficiently, and that's good for farmers. And that's why farmers have been using antibiotics as additives in the feed for the last 70 years. And that, when I put that together about 10 years ago, I realized, well, if farmers can make their farm animals bigger by giving them antibiotics, maybe all the antibiotics we're giving our kids are doing the same. And since then, we've had epidemiologic studies, we've had experimental studies in animals, all showing the same thing. Now, your question was about broad-spectrum antibiotics. And most of the antibiotics that are being used in the United States are broad-spectrum. The whole arc of development of antibiotics since World War II is to make broad-spectrum antibiotics. So if someone's ill with a wound or with pneumonia, we can give an antibiotic, and we know with reasonable confidence that that antibiotic is going to be effective in most patients, which is great. And it works very well if that antibiotic does not have cost. That is, cost in terms of its effects, its collateral effects on the good bacteria. Now that we're beginning to assess that, we see that antibiotics are having a lot of collateral effects, and I'm predicting that we're going to want to develop narrow-spectrum antibiotics so that if a child has a strep throat, the doctor of the future will take off from the shelf an antibiotic that's only good against strep and that will treat strep and won't have any effect. It's kind of like using a laser rather than carpet bombing.
This use of antibiotics with farm animals is one that's rather serious, since it obviously gets into our food supply. Could you comment on what's the solution there? I guess that's why people buy organic beef?
That's why they do, and that's why Europe banned the use of antibiotics for growth promoters about a decade ago. And I see more and more companies in the United States are saying we're not going to use antibiotic. McDonald's just said that they're phasing out use of chickens that come from farms that use antibiotics for growth promotion. Tyson Chicken announced that a few years ago. And the FDA is calling for farmers to do this on a voluntary basis. And I think it's a step in the right direction, but it's really not enough, because there are all kinds of effects that are happening downstream of this. Yes, meat is a little cheaper when the farmers are using these low-dose antibiotics for growth promotion. They're not therapeutic doses of antibiotics to treat infection. They're low doses of antibiotics. So our meat's a little cheaper, but the antibiotics are getting in our – they're in the meat. There are surveys in supermarkets that even though they're not supposed to be there, they often are there. In some cases, they're in milk that our children drink. And in some communities, the antibiotics are present in drinking water. All of these are at very low levels. And the question is, do low levels matter? And no one knows the answer to that question. But it's an important question because millions of people are being exposed. And it's a question that we really need to answer because it has potential consequence.
It's really difficult for me to walk into any office on our campus and not see a bottle of sanitizer, which everybody's supposed to punch and wipe their hands off. Tell us about the role that plays in this issue.
Yeah, well, I'm struck by that, too. In fact, I've over the years, I've developed a photo collection of, you know, hand sanitizer bottles in lots of interesting places that where you wouldn't exactly expect it. Hand sanitizers are very important under certain circumstances. For example, in hospitals, they're really important because there are antibiotic-resistant organisms that are traveling around from person to person, from patient to patient on people's hands. So hand washing is extremely important. And it's also good during flu season because hands are important for transmitting influenza. But most of the time, it's not flu season, and most of the places are not hospitals. And someone, some great marketing companies got the idea of, well, just sell American people on the idea that germs are bad. And the more you wash your hands, the healthier you're going to be. No evidence, but it is part of our culture. My concern, actually, is that it could be doing more harm than good. We think we're improving health, but in fact, we might be worsening health.
So when I cruise through the supermarket or the drugstore, I'm looking at an increasing number of probiotics that are on the market, and they're so confusing, I can't figure it out. I wonder if you could help us understand whether or not that helps. Does that help put the good bacteria back in the body? And where does a consumer go to figure all that out?
Right, right. I think that's the other extreme. You know, if the one extreme is excessive hand washing, the other extreme is about probiotics. What I can tell you, just as you say, if you go to the supermarket or the pharmacy or the health food store, there are hundreds of products all labeled as probiotics. According to the laws, they can call themselves probiotics. They're food supplements. What I can say is that they are quite varied in what they are. Again, hundreds of different kinds of products. Generally, they're safe, although not 100% safe, but generally safe, and almost completely untested. So your guess is as good as mine.
So given the research that you're doing on a daily basis, what's the next great solution here? What are you looking for at the moment that is really going to clear this up if it's not clear enough already? And believe me, your book is very convincing as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I think that the research is really important. We live in a world where most people believe in the power of science. Science brought us to the moon. Science enabled us to create the internet and to create antibiotics, which are marvelous drugs. My specialty in medicine is infectious diseases, and there are times when we give antibiotics and we save people's lives, absolutely. It's just that the times when we're giving antibiotics and they have no effect are so many times more. So one is, you know, that I'm preaching a public health campaign for us to really examine which are the times that we need antibiotics and which are the times that we need to wash our hands carefully with antibacterial substances and which are the times that moms need to give birth by C-section. You know, now it's a third of the babies born in the United States are born by C-section. In some countries, it's 50% of the babies. And yet, in medically advanced countries like the Netherlands and Sweden and Norway, it's about 15%. So this is practice and custom and expectation. I guess my public health message is all this stuff has cost. In the laboratory, we're trying to understand exactly what are the critical periods, which are the bacteria that are being affected that may make a difference, because maybe one day we can give those bacteria back to kids. If we knew which ones were being lost, which part of our diversity was going down, maybe that could be a solution. Ultimately, I think we're going to have to develop narrower spectrum antibiotics, just as we discussed before, so that instead of treating an infection with an atom bomb, we can treat it with a laser. We'll need better diagnostics for that. So there's a lot of room for research, and that research is going to cost money. And I think that's where our tax dollars should go. Just as when we need to build a new interstate highway, we use our tax dollars to build the roads because no one can afford to do this themselves. But collectively, we can do it. And the concern is that if we don't, the drugs that are selling for $5 and $10, they seem like they're cheap. They seem like they're a bargain. But I'm concerned because of their broad spectrum that they're having big costs down the line.
Well, Dr. Blaser, I'd like to thank you for taking time out of your research and medical practice to deliver this public service message. Again, the name of the book is Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues, Martin J. Blaser. Thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you very much for your interview.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Martin J. Blaser. Next week, Mary Elise Cerotti, author of The Collapse, The Accidental Opening of the Berlin Wall. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Ralph Poor. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.